Since the loss of his sight, Richard Bennett has gained his impressions of the world around him through touch and smell and sound. Now he uses a new device, sonic glasses, which add a new dimension to his world. The glasses, designed not for sight, but for sound, emit ultrasonic pulses, which strike objects in Richard Bennett's path and return as audible and meaningful echoes. Richard Bennett has become a human parallel to the bat, echolocating as he travels, interpreting the sounds that make up a picture of his world. As with Richard Bennett's sonic glasses, technology has often imitated nature, consciously or not. Science tries to do for human beings what time has done for other creatures, adapt them to a world without light. The wonder is not that science and technology can help a man adjust to blindness, nor is it that man, like other creatures, has senses and instincts to help guide him through an endless night. The real wonder is that a human being, unlike any other creature, can adapt to an element not his own, through the sheer power of his intelligence and determination.
Now it's time to go sleepy by, you worthless piece of garbage.
Such a thing is more than enough to fill one's life, and this is the very sense of fullness I want to talk to you about. I don't mean fullness because of the protoplasm I had, because even if it had increased to a considerable degree, it wasn't anything exceptional. Cells, of course, are full of protoplasm. What else could they be full of? No, I'm talking about the sense of fullness that was, if you will, allow the expression, quote, spiritual, unquote, namely, the awareness that the cell was me, the sense of fullness, this fullness of being aware, was something that kept me awake nights, something that made me beside myself. In other words, the situation I mentioned before, I was dying of love. Now I know all of you will raise raise a flock of objections, because being in love presupposes not only self-awareness, but also awareness of the other, etc., etc. And all I can answer is, thanks a lot, I know that much myself. But if you aren't going to be patient, there's no use in my trying to explain. And above all, you have to forget for a minute the way you fall in love nowadays. The way I do too now, if you'll permit me the confidences of this sort. I say confidences because I know that if I told you about my falling in love at present, you could accuse me of being indiscreet. Whereas I can talk without any scruples about the time when I was a unicellular organism. That is, I can talk about it objectively, as the saying goes, because it's all water under the bridge now, and it's a feat on my part even to remember it. And yet, what do I remember? What I do remember is still enough to disturb me from head to foot. So when I use the word objectively, it's a figure of speech, as it always is when you start out saying you're objective, and then one with one thing and the other, you end up being subjective. And so this business I want to tell you about is difficult for me, precisely because it keeps slipping into the subjective. My subjective state of those days, which, though I recall it only partially, still disturbed me from head to foot, like my subjective of the present. And that's why I've used expressions that have the disadvantage of creating confusion with what is different nowadays, while they have the advantage of bringing to light what is common between the two times. First of all, I must be more specific about what little I remember, or rather, I should warn you that if certain parts of my story are narrated less fully than others, it doesn't mean they're less important, but only that they are less firm in my memory, since what I remember well is my love stories and love stories' initial phase, if you want to call it that. I would almost say the preceding phase, at the climax of the love story, my memory dissolves, frays, goes to pieces. There's no way for me to remember then what happens afterward. I say this not to ward off objections that I'm trying to make you listen to a love story. I don't even remember, but to clarify the fact that not remembering it is, at a certain point, necessary to make the story this one and not another. In other words, while the story usually consists of the memory you have of it, here, not remembering the story becomes the very story itself. So I'm speaking, then, of the initial phase of a love story, which afterward is probably repeated in an interminable multiplication of initial phases, just like the first and identified with the first, a multiplication of, or rather a squaring, an exponential growth of stories, which is always tantamount to the first story. But it isn't as if I were so very sure of all this. I assume it is, as you can also assume it. I'm referring to an initial phase that precedes the other initial phases, a first phase, which must surely have existed, because it's logical to expect it to exist, and also because I remember it very well. And when I say it's the first, I don't at least mean first in the absolute sense. That's what you'd like me to mean, but I don't. I mean first in the sense that we can consider any one of these identical initial phases the first, and the one I refer to is the one I remember. The one I remember as first in the sense that before it, I don't remember anything. And as for the first in the absolute sense, your guess is as good as mine. I'm not interested. Let's begin this way, then. There is a cell, and this cell is a unicellular organism. And this unicellular organism is me, and I know it, and I'm pleased about it. Nothing special so far. Now let's try to represent this situation for ourselves in space and time. Time passes, and I, more and more pleased with being in it and with being me, am also more and more pleased that there is time, and that I am in time. Or rather, that time passes and I pass time and time passes me, or rather I am pleased to be contained in time, to be content of time, or to be a container, in short, to mark by being me the passing of time. Now you must admit, this begins to arouse a sense of expectation, a happy and hopeful waiting, a happy, youthful impatience, and also an anxiety, a youthful, excited anxiety, also basically painful, a painful, unbearable tension and impatience. In addition, you must keep in mind that existing also means being in space, and in fact, I was dished out into space to my full width, with space all around, and even though I had no knowledge of it, it obviously continued on all sides. There's no point in bothering now about what else this space contained. I was enclosed in myself and I minded my own business, and I didn't even have a nose I couldn't stick my nose out, or an eye to take an interest in outside, and what was and what wasn't. However, I had the sense of occupying space within space, of wallowing in it, of growing with my protoplasm in various directions. But as I said, I don't want to insist on this quantitative and material aspect. I want to talk, above all, about the satisfaction and the burning desire to do something with space, to have time to extract enjoyment from space, to have space to make something in the passing of time. Up until now, I've kept time and space separated to help you understand me better. Or rather, so that I could understand better what I should make you understand. But in those days, I didn't really distinguish too clearly what was one of them from the other was. There was me, in that point and at that moment, right? And then there was the outside, which seemed to me a void I might occupy in another moment or point. And a series of other points or moments. In short, a potential projection of me where, however, I wasn't present. And therefore, a void which was actually the world and the future. But I didn't know that yet. It was void because perception was still denied me, and as for imagination, I was even further behind, and when it came to mental categories, I was a total loss. But I had this contentment, because outside of me, there was this void that wasn't me, which perhaps could become me, because me was the only word I knew. The only word I could have declined. A void that could become me, however, wasn't me at that moment, and basically never would be. It was the discovery of something else that wasn't yet something, but anyhow, wasn't me, or rather, wasn't me at that moment, and in that point, and therefore was something else, and this discovery aroused an exhilarating enthusiasm in me, a torment, a dizzying torture, the dizziness of a void which represented everything possible. The complement of that fullness was for me all, and I was brimming over with love for this elsewhere, this other time, this otherwise silent and void. So you see that when I spoke of being in love, I wasn't saying something so far-fetched. You were always on the point of interrupting me to say, in love with yourself, in love with yourself. And I was wise to pay no attention and not use or let you use that expression there. You see, that being in love was even then searing passion for what was outside me. It was the writhing of one who yearns to escape outside himself. As I then went rolling around in time and space, dying of love. Dying of love.